Because of the great interest and response to our Alternative Views program on the savings and loan crisis, we've decided to replay it for you.
Essentially, the savings and loan industry has collapsed. Even using that number, $166 billion, the original bailout bill estimated that 300 SNLs would cost that. Now, with the new capital requirements in 1992, 1,800 will go down. That's six times what was originally projected. And six times $166 billion is a trillion. Edwin Gray, who was the head bank examiner nationally, the head of the bank board, he testified that the U.S. League of Saving Institutions, which is the head lobby group of the savings and loans, told him not once but on several occasions that the overriding strategy of the savings and loan industry was to buy time, to buy time, and to buy time until only the taxpayer could bail it out. Seldom in our experience as accountants have we encountered a more egregious example of the misapplication of generally accepted accounting principles, said Johnson. Lincoln created profits by making loans. Many of the loans were bad. Lincoln was manufacturing profits by giving its money away. Well, Keating didn't care. I mean, it was all insured, right? It was fraud. Well, Keating paid bonuses to Lincoln employees who sold junk bonds in ACC in place of CDs. All of the deposits were insured. So there was no risk to them whatsoever. I mean, borrowers were told they didn't have to pay the money back. It was all insured. Just take it. There were kickback scams. There were conspiracies all over the country. Little groups of SNLs here and there. There were daisy chains, where a group of SNLs would pass bad assets from one to the other, keeping them ahead of the examiners. So the examiners were coming in. We'd sell off our bad loans to you. The examiners leave, you sell them back, the examiner goes to you, everything's fine.
All of the renegade CIA agents that were involved in the Bay of Pigs, Iran-Contra, Watergate, Frank Castro, for example, was in jail in 1984 for smuggling marijuana. And he was released to train some Contras, and in the meantime, he was involved with a savings and loan in Florida, Sunshine Bank, which was bought with drug money, and a known CIA agent was the front.
The savings and loan crisis is of immense proportions. It's also a very complex phenomenon, but we'll try to unravel some of it and clarify some of it for you right now on Alternative Views. The SNL crisis, some people say, well, it's going to bring down the whole U.S. economy all by itself. And if it doesn't by itself, it will with other problems with the banking industry and the great debt which corporations and individuals have in this country. We're going to find out the latest status of the SNL crisis and what's been happening with Rob Widdowson, who's one of the country's experts on it. We did a previous program in which Rob told us a lot of the escapades of some of these crooks who have drained and destroyed the SNL system. We're going to get an update. The most recent thing I heard was they're finally admitting incrementally over the weeks, well, it isn't going to cost so many billions, it's going to cost more billions. The latest thing is $500 billion. But you see it as a lot more than that, don't you, Rob?
Well, you're right, Frank. I think it is going to cost us a lot more. And you were right to use the word incremental. Essentially, the savings and loan industry has collapsed. Most analysts, serious analysts, feel that it's not going to survive this crisis. And it would have collapsed quickly if the entire truth had been told when it happened. But the government was afraid that there would be another immediate Great Depression with the collapse of the banking system. And so the system has been propped up, and it will disappear slowly over several years, during which time we will slide into a depression in this country.
How much do you think it's going to cost the taxpayers altogether? What's your projection?
At least $1 trillion and probably more.
$1 trillion? Now, that's a $500 billion difference between what the government is admitting now and what you're saying. What is where's the extra $500 billion coming from?
Well, I mean, you've got to go back to the original bailout bill, in which taxpayers were supposed to pay $50 billion for 300 SNLs, which were going to be taken over. Now, 2 weeks after the bailout bill was passed, the Bush administration was saying that it was inadequate. One of the reasons is that part of the bailout bill is that the requirements, capital requirements for the savings and loans have increased. The capital requirement is that the amount of money that's left over after a bank pays off all its depositors and pulls in all of its loans. So in other words, theoretically, that could happen on any given day. And so a bank has to have a surplus for safe operation. And that surplus is called the capital requirement. It was 1.5% of total deposits for savings and loans banks during the deregulation era. Part of the bailout bill is to increase the capital requirement in two steps. Now, the first step was January 1st, 1990. Because of that, an additional 400 savings and loans are going to go down. They can't meet those requirements. They don't have enough capital reserve. So that's why the numbers are changing. Okay. Now, what they're not telling us is that the capital requirements are going to double again in 1992 to 6%. And, again, most serious analysts feel that at least two-thirds of the SNLs in this country will not be able to meet those requirements, which means 1,800 SNLs are going to fail.
And that means the government will take those over and assume all those bad debts.
Or they'll have to come up with something more creative, because that's going to happen. Doesn't seem to be any question. So, the original bailout bill was $50 billion, and the number with interest on the loans, the usual number used is $166 billion total cost. But that's only the first 10 years of interest payments. The loans, the $50 billion loan, is being made with 30-year bonds. So that means the interest will spread over actually 30 years. And the actual cost of $50 billion is in the realm of $225 billion over 30 years. But the number that's usually used is $166 billion, which is the first 10 years after the crisis. Okay. Now, even using that number, $166 billion, the original bailout bill estimated that 300 SNLs would cost that. Now, with the new capital requirements in 1992, 1,800 will go down. That's six times what was originally projected. And six times $166 billion is $1 trillion.
Okay. Now, doesn't it, it's amazing to me that 6% capital requirement doesn't seem unreasonable. That they, it seemed like they should, any bank would have their hands on 6%, you know, for cash.
That's standard for commercial banks. But you got to remember, if you're talking about $1 billion, 6% of $1 billion is a lot of cash to have on hand. That's a lot of money. The other problem is that the savings and loan industry during deregulation was at 1.5%. And, you know, many of these banks are in trouble right now. And so for them to pull in, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in some cases.
I see.
It's just too much.
Why has it taken so long for the Bush administration to take action and get something going on this? I mean, this is an enormous, devastating economic crisis that we're in, and yet they're just dawdling along and not doing anything much about it.
Well, now you bring up a point that bears on the Resolution Trust Corporation. Okay, remember that the bailout bill established the Resolution Trust Corporation, a semi-federal agency that was off budget, so that they wouldn't have to worry so much about Graham Rudman, the budgetary limitations. So that $50 billion that they borrowed, $20 billion they borrowed from the Treasury, so it's on budget, but $30 billion they decided to borrow off budget. That is to say, it wouldn't be listed in the U.S. deficit. So that they could meet Graham Rudman.
Were they able to sell those bonds as easily as the Treasury bonds?
Well, they had to offer them a little higher interest rate because they were not directly from the Treasury. That alone is going to cost about $5 billion, that extra 0.25% in interest. That was the first purpose of the Resolution Trust Corporation. The second purpose was to have a place to put all the assets that were seized from failed and failing savings and loans. So the Resolution Trust Corporation now owns all of the bad assets, including the bad mortgages, the bad loans, the anything that was given in collateral on those loans, which is right now about $400 billion worth of assets. Half of it is real estate. The problem is that 40% of that real estate, 25 to 40%, it's hard to tell right now, is raw land with no economic value whatsoever. 35% of those assets are tied up in litigation. There's no clear title yet. Nobody knows who owns it. Okay? It's just a disaster. They don't even have a clear catalog to what they have in the Resolution Trust Corporation. All of these properties, this is just a disaster. All of these properties, taxes have to be paid on them. They have to be maintained. In some cases, there are vandalized office buildings and apartment buildings. The carrying costs for the assets of the Resolution Trusts, the government's estimate, so it's bound to be low, is 25 to 40% annually.
Which amounts to how much?
Well, if we've got $400 billion now, 25% would be $100 billion a year to carry those assets. Now.
And this is part of the $1 trillion that you figured?
No, that's not even in there.
Oh, my God.
Now, the government is in a real hard place. There's enormous carrying costs are building up and building up and building up. And so it's to all of our best interests for them to dispose of these assets as quickly as possible. Of course. However, if they do, the enormity of the assets is such that the bottom will drop out of the real estate market. It already is. Unfortunately, the rest of the banking system is badly overextended in real estate loans. And so, if the Resolution Trust dumps all that property into the market, then all the banks in the country will fail. And we'll have a depression.
But if they don't sell this stuff, then
That's right.
The meter will keep running and
exactly
when the taxpayers
those enormous carrying costs. Enormous carrying costs. At the first of the year, George Bush submitted his first budget, and in that budget he asked for $100 billion extra. Okay, in working capital, they called it, for the Resolution Trust Corporation to close down more SNLs and to pay those carrying costs.
Now, those carrying costs go to whom?
Well, their taxes are paid to the government. Uh-huh. Property managers, real estate people, appraisers, lawyers. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an incredible boon for them. In fact, there are groups of important investors who have gotten together and established companies to manage property. National companies to manage property. Of course, they're going to make a fortune.
Are these some of the same scumbags who ran the SNLs into the ground to start out with?
They might be, and they're certainly friends. But anyway, that's the problem. It's a rock and a hard place. The meter is running. It's in the enormous carrying costs. It was just announced that the Treasury Department gave the Resolution Trust permission to borrow $45 billion this quarter directly from the Treasury.
Off budget again.
Well, nobody knows about the budget. They haven't decided yet. Although, if it is on budget, it means that Graham Rudman has already been exceeded 6 months into the year. But there is an escape clause in Graham Rudman that says that money borrowed after a certain point during the fiscal year will not go on budget. So I think they've waited until that point. So, but anyway, every quarter they're going to come back and just get permission from the Treasury. There's no oversight. Congress isn't involved. It's just directly drawn out. Now, they say they're going to pay it back with the sale of assets out of the Resolution Trust. But, I mean, even their rosiest projections is that, not 20 or 30% of that's going to be covered.
Now, why didn't they take quick action to start out with? Oh, was there another factor other than that they would depress the real estate market?
There certainly was. This whole disaster is based in, well, there's only one way to say it, a conspiracy. A conspiracy of really unbelievable proportions. And it began back at the beginning of the savings and loan crisis when the banks got deregulated. The savings and loan industry was on the ropes anyway. During the 70s, because of inflationary pressures, interest rates were allowed to float. And what that meant was that the savings and loans, who were limited to the amount that they could offer in deposits, interest on deposits, were getting beaten badly because people were taking their money out of SNLs and going to places that could offer higher rates. So those interest rate caps were taken off, and the SNL started to compete with big banks for big bucks. But they were still limited to mortgages, basically. And so in 1982, there was the Garin-San Germain Deregulation Act that said they could do anything. They could invest directly in real estate. They could car loans, credit cards. They could do it all. And so now they were big money was coming into them, and now they could do what they wanted with it. Unfortunately, in that deregulation bill, they left in the insurance part so that there was no risk for these bankers.
Insuring all accounts up to $100,000.
Right, exactly. And that's where all the money was coming from. Money was coming from brokered deposits, which is where corporations or wealthy folks give a lot of money. For example, if you had $1 million, you'd give it to a broker who would then break it up into 10 $100,000 chunks to meet the insurance limit and then deposit it in 10 different savings and loans around the country that were offering the highest interest rates. So billions poured in. I mean, they doubled, tripled, quadrupled their assets in a year many of them, all around the country. One went from 11 million to 792 million in assets in 18 months. I mean, it was ridiculous. So, they were having fun. All this money was pouring in. Mm-hmm. Now, some of them started to get overextended and started to fail. Yeah. And when they failed, the insurance fund of the savings and loan industry had to pay off those deposits.
FSLIC.
FSLIC. The Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation. And the way the charter read was that the savings and loan industry, when you bought in, you bought a piece of the insurance corporation. And you paid in a certain amount based on the deposits that you had in your bank every year. And so it built up to $5 billion or so, and that's what was used to bail out these banks, to pay off the depositors. Now, it was the responsibility of the savings and loan industry to take care of itself, to insure those deposits. Although the federal government said in the charter, backed with the full faith and credit of the United States Treasury. Okay, and that was their big mistake. Because in the 80s, after deregulation, when the banks started to fail, the rest of the industry got together and they said, wait a minute, we're in trouble. Because our insurance fund is going to get depleted here pretty soon. And we're responsible for paying off all those deposits. So what are we going to do? Because we don't want to pay all that money. So what they decided to do was to keep the extent of the losses secret. Until so much money had hemorrhaged out that they didn't have enough to pay it off.
And the only recourse was to have the taxpayers pick up the bill then.
The full faith and credit of the United States Treasury. So their plan was to let the losses get so bad that they would have to go to the government and say, look, if we try and pay this off, there's going to be a crash, a collapse of our banking system. And the country will go into a depression. So you have to bail it out.
Was this in collusion with the executive branch of the government and Congress?
Well, who knows? Who knows? However, in testimony in 1985, before a congressional committee, Edwin Gray, who was the head bank examiner nationally, the head of the bank board, he testified that the U.S. League of Saving Institutions, which is the head lobby group of the savings and loans, told him not once, but on several occasions, that the overriding strategy of the savings and loan industry was to buy time, to buy time, and to buy time until only the taxpayer could bail it out. And he said that in front of Congress in 1985.
Well, it seems to be borne out also by the fact that the Bush administration dawdled and fiddled around and didn't take any action, didn't even appoint the people they were supposed to appoint to run this thing. And so they strung it out. So this fits into the conspiratorial part that you're talking about.
Now, of course, the losses happened pretty fast, a lot faster, I think, than the savings loan industry expected. Although their strategy was to hold out. If they could hold out the full extent of the losses until after the 1988 presidential elections, they felt that then they could go to the government and say that was it. So they had to hold out till then. And
also, it would embarrass the Bush campaign if they came up with it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's interesting you bring that up because in 1987, a gentleman named Danny Wall replaced Edwin Gray as the head regulator. And Danny Wall was a good friend of the savings and loan industry. He had, in fact, written the Garn-San Germain Deregulation Act of 1982 when he was on the staff of Jake Garn's, on Jake Garn's staff.
So he was one of the insiders, one of the buddies, so it was a closed circle.
Oh, yeah.
The regulator was the big buddy with the Congress and with the banking industry itself,
sure.
The SNL.
Sure. Yeah, he was a good friend of theirs. Hey, he met with some of the real famous, notorious SNL owners. Keating met with Wall 7 times in his first few months.
Let's talk. He seems to be the number one villain and scumbag in this whole outfit. It's unbelievable. Well, you've got a good yarn to spin about Keating, do you?
Well,
was it Michael? Charles Keating?
Charles Keating.
Charles Keating, okay.
Well, I mean, this guy... he was, one regular said he was the worst of the worst. And the Keating story is a litany of fraud, abuse, bribery. It's astounding what this guy did. He started in Cincinnati. He was working for another company. And he made him a lot of money. But in the late 70s, the Securities and Exchange Commission started to investigate but the company, particularly Keating, for loaning company funds to his family. So Keating decided to leave Cincinnati, and he went to Phoenix, where he bought a company called American Continental Corporation, ACC. It was a real estate company, and Keating began to dabble in real estate. And one Phoenix official, politician, said that everything changed when Keating hit town. He started handing out money left and right. In a few years, he was donating $100,000 to each of several city council people for their campaigns.
That's the kind the local city council people in Austin would like to have.
Man. I mean, imagine if you want a zoning change as a real estate developer, and you're paying $100,000 to the people in the city council. Well, you know, it's likely you're going to get your real estate. Anyway, he decided he wanted a savings and loan. In 1984, he found Lincoln Savings and Loan in Irvine, California. So he bought Lincoln Savings and Loan, and it became a subsidiary of ACC. That's important later on. His first three investments were $100 million that he gave to Ivan Boesky to invest. $126 million in junk bonds to finance a buyout attempt of Gulf Broadcasting Corporation, and $300 million direct real estate investment to build a enormous lavish hotel in the desert outside of Phoenix called the Phoenicia, which is where he lives. He built himself a palace. Those were his first investments. Now, right around this time, Gray, who was at the time the head examiner nationally, was worried about these risky investments, junk bonds and direct investment in real estate developing. And so he decided to impose a rule. 10% of the assets of any savings and loan could go to those kinds of risky investments. Well, Keating didn't like that. I mean, he'd already, in the first 6 months, he had 80% of the assets in risky places.
My God.
Yeah, 80%. By the way, he bought Lincoln Savings and Loan with $51 million that he borrowed from Drexel's office in Beverly Hills, where Mike Milken lived.
Right, Drexel, Burnham Lambert, and Milken later was indicted.
And they've already gone down.
And the company has gone under.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, Boesky was convicted a few years ago for fraud, insider trading, and so forth. And he did all his work with Milken and Drexel Burnham. So, there are obvious connections here. Anyway, so Keating went to work. He decided that he wanted an exemption from the 10% rule. So the first thing he did was he hired a famous economist to look at his books. He paid Alan Greenspan.
Alan Greenspan, he's the head of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
Okay.
He wasn't then.
Yeah, okay.
He paid him $100,000 to look at Lincoln's books. Well, he took a look, and he said, hey, they're great. But Gray just wouldn't relent. He said, no, 10%, dude. So Keating got mad. Now, this started a battle between Keating and Gray that lasted until Gray was thrown out by them.
And Gray was a top regulator, head of the bank board.
He was the national head of the bank board, and he actually was an honest guy, and he tried to do something about this, but nobody would listen to him. Mm-hmm. He said he was a pariah. You know, he'd make phone calls, and he wouldn't get any calls back, you know. Anyway, Keating once bragged that he spent $11 million trying to get rid of Gray. He offered Gray a job for $300,000 in his company. Gray turned him down. Yeah. I mean, this guy. Okay, so in 1985, a vacancy opened up on the bank board, the committee that Gray presided over. So Keating called Don Reagan, who was the chief of staff in Ron Reagan's White House, and got a friend of his named Lee Henkel placed on the bank board. Henkel owed Keating, or Lincoln Savings and Loan, a lot of money. Okay. So they got him on the bank board, and the very first thing he did was he offered a proposal to exempt Lincoln Savings and Loan from the 10% rule. And so the Department of Justice began to investigate Henkel's connection to Keating, and so Henkel resigned from the bank board. Now, all this time, the San Francisco bank examiners were starting to look at Lincoln's books. And a couple of things they noticed. First of all, they noticed that there were several sham transactions in the books, where Lincoln would have some real estate and would make a loan to a company over here, and then that company would loan the money to this company here, which would then buy the real estate at a big profit for Lincoln. But Lincoln had loaned the money in the first place, so they bought it back from themselves. So they're trying to make the books look good. Right? They sold this big piece of real estate for a big profit. Okay. The second thing they noticed was that the office that they were given at Lincoln Savings and Loan, in which to work to look at the books, was bugged. And so every time they called the main office and said, hey, we found such and such, and we found it, they were picking it up.
How did they figure that out?
Because the executives at Lincoln seemed to have this ESP about what was going on. they were ahead of...
They had all the moves of the Fed covered before they walked in the door. Right?
Exactly. Exactly. So San Francisco recommended that Lincoln be examined closely. They didn't recommend that it be closed yet. That was later. At the same time, while all this was going on, Keating switched auditors. Now, the auditors are what you do if you're a big corporation is you hire a company, an accounting firm, to examine your books and to rate them. And that's for investment purposes, so you can get people to invest your money in your company. So Keating hired Arthur Young Accounting, one of the big...
That's one of the big eight.
Yeah, one of the top accounting firms. They've since merged.
Yeah, this is Big Seven.
Yeah. They've since merged. But the account was given to a guy named Acheson, who was vice president. And Mr. Acheson gave Lincoln's books a clean bill of health all the way through. In fact, he even stepped out of the usual neutral role that auditors are supposed to take when they examine the books and voluntarily went before the bank board to defend Lincoln's accounting practices and try and overturn the 10% rule.
My gosh.
Uh-huh. And, of course, he was turned down. Later on, by the way, the government, in a suit, looked at, had a, an independent auditor look at Lincoln's books at that time. And let me just tell you what the testimony was. They hired Kenneth Leventhal Corporation to examine Lincoln's books. The firm's Roger Johnson testified that Keating Savings and Loan had reported $135 million in pre-tax gains on 15 land transactions. However, and this is a direct quote, there was a net outflow of cash from Lincoln in all 15 cases amounting to $217 million. So instead of $135 on the plus side, they had actually lost $217 million.
Hmm.
Seldom in our experience as accountants have we encountered a more egregious example of the misapplication of generally accepted accounting principles, said Johnson. Lincoln created profits by making loans. Many of the loans were bad. Lincoln was manufacturing profits by giving its money away. Well, Keating didn't care. I mean, it was all insured, right?
Yeah. Well, so, this is the stuff that Arthur Young Man said was okay.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he went before the board and defended it.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, in 1988, Mr. Acheson...
From Arthur Young.
From Arthur Young, yeah. Had to leave the firm. Somebody had made him an offer he couldn't refuse. That's right. He took a job with ACC, Keating's company, for $1 million a year. And that was the accounting firm.
Gee, I can feel the slime just oozing off my body.
Just wait. As the story goes on, the numbers get bigger and bigger and bigger. Oh. It's unbelievable what this guy did next. Right at that time, Edwin Gray was not reconfirmed in his position as head of the bank board by the Congress. Instead, Danny Wall was put in.
The old buddy in the system.
That's the guy. Jake Garn's friend who had written the Garn Central.
So they finally got their insider buddy to be head of the bank board.
That's right. And interestingly enough, just before Wall took office, he met with Keating. Keating gave him a check for $100,000 for the Garn Institute, a think tank, a conservative economic think tank. When Wall took office, in the first few months he was there, he met with Keating 7 times. Nobody knows what they talked about. The meetings were secret. But just after that, Wall told William Seidman of the FDIC in the hall at the water fountain that he had the Lincoln problem taken care of. And there was also an internal memo in the bank board that said that the Lincoln case was politically dangerous, that any discussion was to be kept private, non-public, off the books, off the record, and that any problems with Lincoln were to be referred directly to Danny Wall. 6 months after he took office, Wall, by this time, the San Francisco bank examiners recommended that Lincoln be closed. And Keating was really on the ropes. And so he hired, I shouldn't say that, he called 5 senators, friends of his, to whom he had donated money for their campaigns, to go and talk to those regulators and try and straighten them out. And they did. And They told those examiners that they were being mean to Mr. Keating, that he was really a nice guy and he didn't deserve that kind of treatment and they should lay off.
Is this the famous five or whatever?
That's the famous Keating Five.
The Keating Five.
Right.
Who were they?
They were the 2 senators from Arizona, McCain and DeConcini, Senator Glenn, John Glenn, and then Regal. Don Regal, who was head of the banking committee in the Senate, and Alan Cranston, liberal Democrat from California. They all needed money. They were all broke, you know, campaign funds. So, by the way, you know, the usual number is that $1.3 million was donated to those 5 people. But what's usually not mentioned is that Senator McCain took several trips to Bermuda and the Bahamas, paid for by Keating, he and his wife. And when that information became public, he paid him back, you know, some $15,000 or something like that for the trips. And also, more importantly, DeConcini's top aides received $50 million in real estate loans from Lincoln Savings and Loan. So, I mean, it was serious money. So the senators took it upon themselves to get together with San Francisco examiners. But the examiners would not relent. They were mad at Keating. I mean, he tried to, he offered jobs to a couple of people in the office. And, I mean, he was...
They're the real heroes in this.
Uh-huh. They just kept
pushing. Do we know who they are?
Well,
that's all right.
Pastore is the name of the head regulator, and his wife was a lawyer in the office, and Keating offered her a job. in any event, the San Francisco examiners had recommended the bank be closed because of these sham transactions. So Danny Wall moved the case to his office where he could watch it personally. And so he looked at those transactions, and he decided that they were not sham at all, that they were real transactions, and he said that they would be allowed. Okay? He overrode. Well, the San Francisco office kept hammering and kept hammering, and despite the Keating Five and despite all the tactics, eventually, in early part of 1989, a little over a year ago, January 1989, the bank board finally said that indeed those transactions, some of them, were sham. $124 million were sham. Now, Lincoln was a subsidiary of ACC. Remember I said this was important. And the reason that Lincoln wanted these profits on the books was so that they could pay taxes. That sounds weird. They wanted to pay taxes. But those taxes went to the parent company, not directly to the IRS. So the subsidiary paid its taxes to ACC. And then ACC was supposed to put the money in the IRS. However, 95 million dollars was paid in taxes from Lincoln to ACC from 1985 to 1988, end of 1988, and it disappeared. It never got to the IRS. Okay, so here was Keating's problem. When they disallowed the $124 million in profits, they also said that he had to pay $60 million in taxes, overpaid taxes, back from ACC to Lincoln. And he didn't have it. He was really in trouble. Well, on April 1st, Keating got word that the regulators were going to close Lincoln. Okay, now he was tipped off. These are supposed to be secret. Okay, but he was tipped off. And it was very expensive. Because what he did was he sold all of the good assets out of Lincoln to other subsidiaries of ACC. And then he declared bankruptcy for ACC, put it into Chapter 11. And he protected all those assets.
He's kind of a genius in a way.
I don't know how this guy was in the banking business. I mean, he was in the sleaze business. I mean, he must have spent all his time doing these machinations and manipulations. But, I mean, it gets worse and worse. He declared bankruptcy. And so, out of the closet came all of these middle-income, low-income people who had bonds from ACC.
They bought into the company. They hadn't people who didn't have CDs or deposits, but actually had bonds that they bought of ACC then.
Yeah, but they had bought them at Lincoln thinking that they were CDs, insured.
Oh, I see.
Insured bonds.
Oh, but they weren't then.
No, it was a scam. It was an illegal scam. It was fraud. Well, Keating paid bonuses to Lincoln employees who sold junk bonds in ACC in place of CDs.
Oh,
so,
my God.
All of these people, 23,000 of them, to the tune of $225 million. 23,000 people went into Lincoln Savings and Loan, thought they were buying insured CDs. They brought their life savings in. One guy retired. He was 65 years old. He brought in $1,000 for every year of his life he'd been saving. And he bought a CD that he thought was insured.
Oh, my God.
And what he got was a junk bond of ACC. $225 million. In one case, this is incredible. I mean, it's like a B-movie. They had testimony before Gonzalez's committee in Congress. In one case, a blind widow got $30,000 from her husband's life insurance policy. She called up Lincoln Savings and Loan, and this nice young man offered to come to her house and pick her up and bring her to the bank because she was blind. When they got to the bank, he had to read her the contract. because she was blind.
Oh, my God.
And he left out the fine print. Okay. Now her money's gone. It's gone. She may never see it. You know, as part of the bankruptcy, they're supposed to figure out ways to pay it off. But, I mean, that money is gone. Okay. So, that's what Keating did. Now, you know, you say, well, it's business, you know, losses. Did he profit? Well, from 86 to 88, Keating and his family took, it's known that he took $34 million out of SEC. When he declared bankruptcy, he took a salary, 90% salary cut. It was generous of him. He went from $5 million to $500,000. He's still being paid $500,000 a year to run that country, to operate that bankrupt company. Huh. It's known that ACC had a subsidiary. Oh, I know. It's incredible, Frank. ACC had a subsidiary in Panama, the famous money laundering center. And, all those records are secret. Nobody knows how much money passed through that company. But, interestingly enough, as part of the bankruptcy proceedings, a creditor came out of the woodwork. Credit Suisse, Swiss bank, came forth with a bill to Keating and Lincoln Savings and Loan for $24 million in consulting fees. Now, I don't know how much money was behind that consultation, but that was $24 million in consulting fees. So you can imagine what Credit Suisse was doing for Mr. Charles Keating.
Isn't that the bank that created such a scandal in Switzerland, where they found that it was laundering a lot of drug money, and the head person in Switzerland, who is a cousin of a big Politico here in the United States, she was involved in it as well.
Uh-huh. Credit Suisse.
Yeah. And so...
It's gone.
They're all interconnected.
It's gone, yeah.
So there was drug money involved with that bank. So and also the fact that they were in Panama, where so much drug money is laundered.
The point is that it's money laundering. You know, whether it comes from Charles Keating or whether it comes from the Medellin cartel, it's money that's got to be cleaned. Whether it comes from a defense contractor or, you know.
Oh, I see.
One other thing you should know about Charles Keating is all this time he was funding anti-porn campaigns in cities all around the country. And he's a founding member and the chief contributor in an organization called Citizens for Decency Through Law. Charles Keating, paragon of virtue.
Well, now, he's been indicted and all kinds of stuff, hasn't he?
There's been a civil suit against him. He's in court right now because he's suing the government for taking over Lincoln Savings and Loan. He's mad. They took his bank away from him. So he sued the government, and that's where the testimony from the accountants came from, testimony in that trial.
Now, was Keating just an example of stuff like this that was going on everywhere, or is he unusual?
No, he's the classic example. One regulator called him the worst of the worst. But he represents a pattern. With deregulation, the banks were allowed to put their money anywhere, and all of the deposits were insured, so there was no risk to them whatsoever. I mean, borrowers were told they didn't have to pay the money back. It was all insured. Just take it. There were kickback scams. There were conspiracies all over the country. Little groups of SNLs here and there would get together. The reason they would get together is to hide these losses on their books. And in fact, it was so common there was a whole vocabulary that grew up around the accounting tricks to keep the examiners off their backs. There were daisy chains, where a group of SNLs would pass bad assets from one to the other, keeping them ahead of the examiners. So the examiners were coming in, we'd sell off our bad loans to you, The examiners leave, you sell them back, the examiner goes to you, everything's fine. There were things called land flips, where the same piece of land was sold several times in quick succession, each time at a much higher value. Property values were inflated, for example, in one case, 900% in a week. There were things called trading a dead horse for a dead cow, swapping bad assets. Junk bonds were very important here. There were a couple of circles of SNLs who worked with Milken, and they would sell junk bonds one to the other. And that did a couple of things. It would make them look profitable on the books, and it would also keep the value of those bonds high because they were being traded. So all of these things were going on to hide the extent of the losses for two reasons. One is that the owners were getting rich, and the other is that the industry as a whole didn't want the news out that they were losing so much money.
There's one other aspect which we don't have time to go into in great detail, but it surfaced recently as a result of a Houston Post article, and that is that it looks like the CIA and the Mafia were big in the failure of a lot of these SNLs. You've been doing some research into that. You're still continuing your analysis of it, but can you give us a feel for what you found?
Well, this aspect of the scandal, as you say, was written up by a series of articles in the Houston Post by one reporter, a guy named Pete Bruton. And he was looking into the failure of a few savings and loans, and he noticed some mafia-connected names showing up and some CIA-connected names showing up. And in fact, there have been, so far, 23 failed savings and loans whose failures were directly connected to losses that were associated with mafia people and or CIA people. In some cases, the mafia and the CIA work together.
Well, Rob, they've been doing this for years, so do you see any familiar names that have been participating in other CIA activities over the years?
Sure, all of them, Frank. All of the renegade CIA agents that were involved in the Bay of Pigs, Iran-Contra, Watergate, Frank Castro, for example, was in jail in 1984 for smuggling marijuana. And he was released to train some Contras. And, and in the meantime, he was involved with a savings and loan in Florida, Sunshine Bank, which was bought with drug money, and a known CIA agent was the front. There's a web, an intricate network that Pete Bruton at the Houston Post has exposed that connects this group of people, the ex-CIA people, with some of the savings and loan scandalous names, the mafias involved.
Who are some of the more CIA people that?
One of the major deals was done in South Florida. A company called St. Joe's Paper Company sold lots of land, expensive Gulf Coast land, to a gentleman named Lawrence Freeman, who was fronting for a guy named Acheson. Now, James Acheson is a known arms dealer. He's had several companies that have been CIA fronts. In this particular deal, and this is the sort of the centerpiece of Bruton's work, $120 million disappeared. $7 million of it, it was sent to a money laundering center on the Isle of Jersey, which is also used by drug dealers. In fact, Lawrence Freeman, who set up the deal originally, pled guilty to charges of money laundering for a gentleman named Santo Traficante, who's the head mafiosa in Florida.
And the CIA's had relationships with him.
Well, exactly. Yeah. That's the whole point. Names like Freeman was very close with a gentleman named Helliwell, who was one of the founders of the CIA. Back in the days of Bill Donovan of the OSS, and of course William Casey was involved in all of these things.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's just astounding. In addition, through again an intricate network of deals from one savings and loan to another, Silverado Savings and Loan in Denver is a name that keeps popping up.
Yeah.
It was also on a daisy chain to keep junk bonds afloat and sham profits, all those accounting tricks we were talking about.
Oh, isn't that one that George Bush's son
is on the board of directors, was on the board of directors during the time all this was going on. So, I mean, it would take at least one and maybe several programs to detail all of these connections, but... It seems pretty clear, and Bruton has done a lot of work, and he's documented these things quite carefully.
Well, what are your final thoughts about all this in conclusion?
Well, the savings and loan crisis is just that. It's an absolute crisis, and it's a crisis of public trust. There's been a betrayal of the American people at every level of government, including our financial institutions. It's going to change America. This country will never be the same. If there's one thing that comes out of this, it should be, and I hope the American people will wake up and do this, it should be a critical examination of who we are and what we are as a nation. We have to find the structural flaws in our government that allowed this to happen, and we've got to find the moral flaws in our national character that allowed this to happen. And if we don't make some changes, and some pretty creative changes, and pretty soon, I'm afraid that this noble experiment in democracy is over.
And that's Alternative Views for this time. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. We can also give you information on how to get material from John Stockwell. We'd like to thank our crew for today's program, Brian Lynch, Karen Bynes, and Mary Graham. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. If you have any comments or questions, you can contact us at that address. If you'd like to see Alternative Views played in your city, but it isn't played already, you can also contact us there. Bye.